Welcome to the Indisposable Podcast, produced by Upstream and supported this season by Patagonia. I'm your host, Brookine Gatewood. Thanks for joining for another episode celebrating solutions to plastic pollution. Welcome back, everybody. I am here today for a special back-to-school episode with Madam Malhotra and Eileen Farnood, who are high school students who have developed a website resource and podcast called The Plastic Shift, and that's at theplasticshift.com. And we're going to talk with them today about what they're up to, how they got into this project, how on earth they make time for it, and all sorts of good details. And in addition to being sometimes going to school, as Madhav's bio says on the website, he's also training to be a developer, entrepreneur, and consultant, and hoping to solve climate change. And Eileen is interested in brain-computer interfaces, virtual reality, machine learning, AI, particularly for self-driving cars. So these two are clearly passionate, ambitious, intelligent, next-generation leaders, and it's such an honor to have them on the show. So thank you guys so much for joining.
Thank you for having us.
That was nice synchronous response. So I want to start just with the practical curiosity. You guys are based in Canada and sounds like you're just going back to school from the summer in this strange time. So what's the deal with school for you guys right now? Are you virtual? Are you in the classroom? How's that been going?
Yeah, so for me, at least, I've been going to school both in person and at home, and it's been quite difficult to sort of get used to all of this change. I know our school adopted like a very different schedule, and like we planned everything differently from last year. So that's been pretty interesting, but I'm starting to get into the hang of things now that school has been going on for about a month for me. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. For me, I am starting to go back to school online, and there are definitely very many changes compared to last year, but it's been a mix of good and bad, and we're starting to adjust to things, which is good because it'll get busy with university applications soon, so we're all doing our best to keep things going.
So tell us a little bit about how this Plastic Shift project came to be. And what you guys are up to and what some of the exciting latest activities are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we started off essentially working on just a project for an extracurricular. I know Madhav and I have dabbled in the plastic space beforehand, but we hadn't really done anything serious. And so during that project, we were really focusing on looking into sort of what are the potential solutions to the plastic pollution problem that are prevalent in today's world. And then while we were doing that sort of research, we spent a lot of time digging in on what is currently being done, like what is working, what hasn't been working. And we found that there was like a general trend with a lot of these different solutions that people have been implementing where they weren't really tackling the root cause of the problem. For example, we saw a lot of organizations were really involved in beach cleanups, which we think are great, except it's only very short term with regards to the impact. And so we were thinking if we wanted to actually make some sort of change and if we wanted to actually push forward and start tackling the plastic pollution problem in a better way, we needed to identify these solutions that could tackle the root cause of the issue. That sort of was what prompted us to create the Plastic Shift in the first place. And our goal was to educate people on sort of all aspects of the problem. And our hope was to identify sort of what were these more promising solutions and then push organizations and companies to essentially work on those more promising areas.
And as we started to kind of get into the summer and kind of collect all of this research together, it was a very big surprise for us to notice how these things, which were very new to us, but seemed to, you know, somewhat make sense, they weren't actually all that common in the industry. So we started to reach out to companies, we started to reach out to nonprofits, and we started to try to share some of these insights that we'd found. And that was kind of how a bunch of serendipity happened. We were able to kind of join forces with other companies, with other nonprofits, and bring a little bit of a new perspective, given that we haven't been in this industry for a long time. But at the same time, we were able to learn a lot and gain a lot of skills over the year. And as a result, now we're starting to kind of move forward in this direction, having created a lot of resources like articles, like podcasts, like research-oriented overviews of the different solutions we've found. And it's kind of now starting to become all about identifying how to next move forward and take all of these things that we've learned about and collect them together to figure out how we can kind of prompt companies or the nonprofits we've met to take action on this issue in a way that might be more effective than we saw before our work.
I'm curious, you said that through your research, you noticed you developed some insights that you weren't seeing out there very much. What were some of those differences that surfaced from the way you guys were analyzing the problem?
Yeah. So one of the key things that we were trying to figure out, first of all, was, well, you know, we were just high school students. We had so much information coming at us from all these different angles. And it was really hard to figure out not only what was actually going on, but then how we could fit into it in trying to create a better solution. And what really guided us on that, especially initially, was just being able to dig through all of these different sources of information and identify the symptoms versus the root causes of different problems we saw. So for example, we might look into problems in ocean litter and think about marine plastics, versus we might look at something like waste management, recycling facilities, incineration plants. And even though that these areas seemed very different to us at first, we started to notice that behind these symptoms, we could usually trace back plastics through not just the end of their life when they might end up in a waste management facility or unfortunately in the ocean, but to the places where consumers actually were using the plastics, where companies were designing their products and making decisions about which materials were used. And in that way, we kind of came up with 8 different pillars of work that we thought was very important in being able to tackle the root causes of this problem. And usually they didn't start with things like cleaning up the ocean, because that was kind of a step that came later. It seemed like we could intervene before that happened. Oftentimes, our root causes included things like how companies can start to redesign their products. So for instance, we identified different types of policies like extended producer responsibility that we thought were very promising in being able to create incentives to design products differently. Or we might come up with root causes related to how most of plastic pollution, the vast majority in fact, enters the ocean through developing countries. And oftentimes these things can include how waste management is set up, so for instance in open dumps, etc. And we identified how to have a large portion of the problem solved in terms of marine plastic pollution, then the area of impact might be to help increase or build better infrastructure for waste management in these countries. And of course, you can imagine there are lots of problems associated with that. So we keep on going into these little tangents. And at first, it was very confusing. But in the end, we created these 8 different pillars that seemed to us to be very promising. And as we started to reach out to companies about this, it was really incredible to see how we've actually been on the right track a little bit. So when we got reinforcement from others, but then also how sometimes the ideas that we'd come up with, they could actually be very practical and useful for the people we talk to.
Now, you say you're reaching out to companies. I'm curious, what kinds of companies? Are you asking them to take action yet, or are you still just in a learning phase and collecting information?
Mm-hmm. Well, when we started off with the plastic shift, we were more awareness-based and more focused on like creating sort of like a knowledge bank which people could refer to. And so during that time, we were reaching out to companies, we were reaching out to professors, experts in the field, et cetera, to sort of gain insight on what does the plastic pollution problem look like right now. And our goal was to gain as many different unique perspectives as possible so we could sort of formulate our own opinions. And so we just like congregated everything together so that we could create those eight pillars that Madhav was mentioning. But recently, or at least over the summer, we moved on towards actually helping companies and pushing them towards implementing better solutions or working on certain projects which we thought would be more effective in tackling the issue. And so we're sort of moving on into like partnering with companies and helping them bring out certain projects. For example, over the summer, we worked with Plastic Bank and we helped them create this Impact Ambassador course, which essentially helps teach individuals about the plastic pollution problem. And they can sort of walk through all the different aspects and learn more about microplastics, about bioplastics, et cetera, all these different facets of the problem. What we're doing right now, though, moving on and going forward, is we are trying to get a whole scope of the entire industry. And recently, what we've been thinking of is more so in terms of how can we generate the biggest impact. We were thinking about working towards this sort of end goal of having a circular economy. And we've been really interested in this idea of a circular economy. We think this is the way to go forward into the future. And so what we did was we were like, okay, if the end goal is a circular economy, let's work backwards and see what sorts of steps we need to take to get there. And so using this sort of formula, we've decided that we want to go forward and start understanding more about the industry and understanding more about how all of the different stakeholders within the plastic industry work together. So for example, talking to people in charge of infrastructure, people who do waste management, people who do packaging. And so right now we're in this stage of just gaining all this information and sort of mapping out the industry to see how all of these pieces connect together. So yeah, it's been a combination of just understanding sort of where everything is right now with regards to plastic pollution, and then using that knowledge to decide what we want to do moving forward.
Yeah. You know, I was reading the article you put out recently called, let me get the title, called Regenerative Economy, the Lesser Known Parts of the Circular Economy. You put it out this July, and I think you were just referring to it. And one of the parts of that article that really struck me was the idea of transforming plastics into some sort of currency as a potential solution. And that was really intriguing and a novel idea for me, and I've been in this space for many years at this point. So I would love to hear you guys talk about that and what potential you see there.
I think that's one of the best examples of this kind of idea was with a company that Eileen mentioned, Plastic Bank. And we started to add a lot of credibility to our initial thoughts on how we could implement this. Because when we were looking into the root causes of plastic pollution, what we found was that through some estimates, such as from organizations like the Ocean Conservancy, the vast majority, up to 80% of plastics in some countries can be very low value. And we were very curious as to what that actually meant. Why was it that these plastics were often not able to be recycled? And why did they often just end up being discarded and thrown in the ocean? And when we dug deeper into this, what we found was that oftentimes when we look at different types of plastics, there are some kinds of plastics, often thermosetting plastics, or some types of plastics like LDPE, which are different polymers that are very, very hard to recycle. And when we looked into why, it was because when we melted down these plastics, which is a part of the recycling process so that we can reshape the plastics into something new, they had their polymers decrease in length. And because of that, the material was often being downgraded, so recycling wasn't very feasible, and there wasn't a lot of demand for this kind of material. People weren't willing to buy it. And that, we thought, was a very, very fundamental problem in how plastics were continuing to be just thrown away and discarded because people weren't willing to pay for them. And some of the solutions that we were initially thinking about was, well, do we need to recycle these plastics by melting them in the first place? So we found some alternatives like using plastics for road cement or getting plastics shredded down instead of melting them to form new useful products. But a lot of this technology was just proof of concept and it didn't have all that much application. So we were actually very discouraged initially. And we were thinking about, you know, not pursuing any deeper into exploring solutions as to how to get around the problem of downcycling plastics. But then we met one of the chief officers at Plastic Bank, and it was just really incredible to hear about how they'd managed to transform this problem of not having enough value out of everyday materials and not solve it in a overly technical way, but solve it in a very economical way. And the key to their work essentially is that they are able to collect plastics from developing countries and they hire very impoverished workers who might not have otherwise had stable employment, especially right now from the effects of COVID. A lot of these informal waste pickers, you can call them, they are facing a lot of challenges. And what happened was with the Plastic Bank, when they hired these workers to collect the plastics, they were able to then brand them in a new way as social plastics and sell them to large companies that were able to kind of brand this product as being socially responsible. And this created an economic incentive where the companies, the large corporations, were willing to pay more for these same materials. And we thought that was a really innovative solution to the problem of low-value plastics. And we think that this kind of work kind of gets at the root cause of what continues the cycle of plastics ending up being discarded or just thrown away in the first place.
Yeah, and another factor we haven't talked about yet that, especially as you're coming off of summer additional research time, are the impacts of COVID and how you have seen that affecting trends. So I'm curious if you guys have been tracking that and having interesting discoveries there.
I think that after COVID, we've kind of started to see a lot of existing problems being amplified. And right now, especially amidst the urgency of everything else that is going on, we have seen a few changes that are very concerning for the future, but unfortunately aren't getting as much attention as they deserve. And in particular, one of the largest changes is a huge amount of increase in plastic production. So in our everyday life, we can think about how we're using personal protective equipment more and more and using disposable products more and more. And there definitely are some situations where this is very necessary. But what we've also started to see on top of that are increases in a lot of false information around the potential dangers of which plastic items might be not suitable to be reused. And this is really something that is amplifying plastic usage on top of what was already going on before, which was that even before COVID, we had decreasing oil prices and it was cheaper to make new plastic. And a lot of companies are investing in that kind of plastic infrastructure right now. And this is going to create problems for us 10 years down the line. There's a lot of great research that you can read about the incentives of this problem, but it's a huge priority for a lot of nonprofits we've been talking to.
Yeah, and just building off of what Madhav was mentioning earlier, what we've seen with COVID and specifically the increase in the use of surgical masks has really contributed to the plastic pollution problem. We've seen that there's an increase in just people like throwing masks as litter on the ground. And recently, I actually was talking to an assistant professor who was conducting a study on sort of the effects of these surgical masks on the environment. And they've already shown that they are responsible for generating microplastics. And sort of this whole increase in the use of just plastic materials and plastics in general that Madhav was talking about has sort of amplified this problem a lot more. And I think because we've been so focused on COVID, we haven't been paying as much mind or as much attention to plastic pollution and the environmental impacts of what we've been adopting so far. And so I think it's really important going forward that people keep in mind that, yes, there is also a pandemic going on, but there's a lot of other problems prevalent that we should also be aware of and not ignore during these times.
And to add to that, one of the key things that we've been challenging businesses to do, so to mention one actionable, is to kind of think about how we've seen this increase in plastics production, but we've also seen some of the movements that have come out against this, where consumers now very increasingly and openly talking about how we still need to care for the environment and the issues we have there are going to continue after the pandemic. And we've been thinking about the ways that it might help businesses to take advantage of this. One thing that we often noticed was that oftentimes businesses, they're very confused right now, and sometimes it can be a little bit hard to take the time to do research on what consumers want or notice how trends in social media are changing. And we thought that there was a lot of room for nonprofits to actually try to make those connections easier and frame their communications in a little bit of a more positive light. So for instance, highlighting how a specific industry, say the beauty industry and the fashion industry, how the consumers there are looking for more sustainable options. And we were recently talking to foundations like the Plastic Soup Foundation that are doing great work on this. And I think that a lot of nonprofits could benefit from kind of stepping in, and even though it's not their job necessarily to do consumer research, etc., try to make that connection more clear for businesses so they can incentivize them more effectively and more positively, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the ecology of approaches, having those who are willing to partner with rather than point a finger at is part of what I hear you pointing to there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, one thing I've been curious about is you're doing this in your spare time while also studying and prepping for college. And, you know, I watched another interview you did with the Ellen MacArthur Foundation where you were talking about that this is fun. And this, you know, part of what motivates you is that you enjoy it, even though it's so daunting, like we were just discussing. So tell us a little bit more about your personal approach to keeping the work positive and how you bring the fun factor in to keep you going.
Yeah, for sure. Like you said, I think sort of what's allowed us to get to this point was in fact that we were prioritizing having fun and enjoying ourselves as we were doing our work. And so for us, that meant working on projects and deciding to do certain tasks, which we thought were actually exciting for us. I thought it was really interesting how we started off not really actually knowing each other that well, but then we prioritized sort of getting to know each other both as friends, but also spending a lot of time on just activities that aren't really work-related, but more so just for bonding and getting to know each other. We spent a lot of time actually discussing how we thought all of these general sort of team dynamic type activities weren't really as effective for us. And so we spent a lot of time just like having fun over the summer as well, as in addition to working on the plastic shift. And so for us, the way that we incorporated this sort of fun element into our work was through sort of gamifying a lot of things as well, I'd say just in general, like when we were having just syncs every day, we would talk about, for example, brainstorming, but doing so in a fun way, and also just talking about how can we make different activities as fun as possible. So maybe giving different role assignments where one person might be really interested in doing one certain thing, another person's interested in doing another thing, and just like suiting those needs. So I think a huge part of it was sort of balancing this aspect of just enjoying what you were doing and then also making sure that you're actually getting your work done. And I thought it was really great that I was able to spend the entire summer with Madhav, because doing such a project alone would have been almost impossible, in my opinion. So I guess this whole experience also really solidified this idea of teamwork, and having a really strong team is important for, I guess, getting stuff done just in general.
Madhav, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I definitely agree with the things that Eileen said, and I definitely couldn't have asked for a better partner this summer. But in addition to that, I also think that even when you think about the gravity of the situation, especially as a youth or as a student, it can be really daunting at first to think about what potential thing you could do that could possibly make a change here. But what really helps is when you actually have something that you're naturally drawn to, something that you're naturally passionate about. Because trust me, there are so many challenges over the summer where, say, I'd reach out to one person and then hear back 2 months later, or I might have to really, really struggle to prioritize different things with school, with the research I'm doing, with other priorities. And in those situations, it's really that even though you might be a great worker, you really just need to have more of a sense of passion and curiosity to pull you along, instead of being rigid and trying to discipline your way through it. Because at the end of the day, when your back is against the wall, it's just always going to be so much easier to stop in the moment instead of keep going. So if you're not having fun while you're doing something, and especially something where you're spending so much time and dedicating so much effort, you're just not going to be able to persevere through all of the challenges that come in the start. So I really think it's important for people to think about what they're actually passionate about when they're choosing what to dedicate themselves into.
Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of different frameworks and quotes coming to mind about what you're saying, because I think it's an age-old piece of wisdom that you're experiencing directly. And I'm thinking about one where you're looking for the Venn diagram intersection of your passions and interests, your skills, and what you're naturally able to do well, and then what the need is in the world. And it sounds like you guys have found a niche for yourself in that way, and incredible research skills and intelligence, interest in the topic, and the world needs help clarifying this complex issue and helping with the public communications. And seems you're also doing a really good job of building partnerships through both the podcast and some of your expert allies that you feature on your website and support your report writing.
We've been very lucky to be able to have found that kind of support, because as we've been bringing up again and again, we literally just were very confused students when we first started. And to have these incredible conversations with experts, I remember just having hour-long discussions with specific people about these topics that I'd never heard about, but then being able to continue those and ask for feedback and help to make decisions as we went along during the summer. I think it's one of the areas where I felt that I personally had grown a lot. And I definitely think that a lot of people kind of, very rightly so, underestimate how much they might be able to do to make a change. But I think that the important thing is to get started, because you never know who you'll meet along the way that might show you a new perspective, that might be able to add some piece of value or advice that can help you compound your work together. And if you, even if you aren't making as big of a change just starting out, I think it's definitely all of the relationships that we've been able to develop over the past summer that have unlocked at least 50% of the opportunities that have come our way. And we never would have predicted it unless we got started.
Yeah, and just like Madhav said, I do think we got really, I guess, lucky, but also it was really unexpected in a good way that so many people were really supportive of our work. But that being said, I do have to say that it wasn't always as easy as it may sound from the get-go, especially near the beginning of when we just started out. It was a much more difficult process of just emailing like hundreds of people trying to see if we could get someone to reply back to us. And so there was a lot of perseverance involved with regards to establishing these sorts of relationships in the first place. But as we moved on over into the summer, we found that it got easier and easier for us to get in contact with different people. And I think it's been really, really great that we've sort of also built our skills on how can we actually reach out to people and network as well.
So as two young people who had an idea and ran with it and catalyzed some pretty big action, do you have any suggestions for our audience on ways to take action in their own lives?
Yeah, I think that we can share a few actionables, and we're actually very excited to think about how more people like us can try to just take whatever their passion is about and make a change. So one actionable we'd have for ordinary people, maybe even youth, but it doesn't matter too much what age you are. I think the thing is to kind of take a look at what your passion is about. And as I said earlier, even though it might not seem like a really big deal for you to do one little thing, like for me, starting out, it was starting a recycling club at my school. You never know where that interest might lead you. So for everyday people, we'd love to leave that as an actionable. And as for businesses or nonprofits, we'd kind of reinforce the idea that we really can work together for this. And though sometimes it might feel like, you know, that person over there is the enemy, I think that if we can start to do these things, such as find common incentives, find common interests, try to think about how, say, a nonprofit could better recognize the business's needs in figuring out consumer demands, or a business could figure out how they can make a few sacrifices in terms of cooperating together, I think that would be the biggest change that we could hope to ask for.
Awesome. Well, thank you guys so much. I want to remind our audience that you guys have a podcast. If anybody's interested in really getting into the weeds on some of these issues, I see a lot of your guests are professors and waste management experts. So to really understand the nitty-gritty, so to speak, The Plastic Shift, available anywhere you get podcasts, just like this one. And their website, theplasticshift.com, has additional resources and articles and the manifesto we talked about today. So I want to encourage everyone to check it out. And I want to thank you guys for joining us today and for the work you're doing and the inspiration. I got to say, for those of us who've been doing this kind of work for a longer time, it is always really heartening to talk to the emerging leaders. So I appreciate the chance to get to speak with the two of you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having both of us.
We really appreciate the conversation, and yeah, we really learned a lot too.
And that's our show. If you like what you're hearing, help spread the word. Subscribe to the Indisposable podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Add a review, talk us up. Nobody spreads a message like you. The Indisposable podcast is brought to you by Upstream, sparking innovative solutions to plastic pollution, envisioning a world without it, and empowering businesses, communities, and individuals to imagine and co-create this future with us. You can find resources mentioned on today's episode, as well as learn more about Upstream's work at www.upstreamsolutions.org. Follow us on social and join the movement. There's a better way than throwaway.